Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me today. As always, we take a look back over the events of the past week here in the Vatican with our friend Joan Lewis. But first, Jill Bevilacqua's program, There's More to the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. This week, Jill reflects on the anniversary of the dedication of the Basilica of St. John Lateran, Rome's cathedral, whose history goes back more than 1,500 years. Let's listen.
The Samaritan woman said to Jesus, "Sir, I can see you are a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you people claim that Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship God." Jesus told her, "Believe me, woman, an hour is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You people worship what you do not understand, while we understand what we worship. After all, salvation is from the Jews. Yet an hour is coming and is already here when authentic worshippers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. Indeed, it is just such worshippers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth."
As with the commemoration of the Holy Souls, the feast of the dedication of St. John Lateran happens to fall this year on a Sunday, taking precedence over the Sunday of the year. The Pope's Cathedral, defined by Clement XII as mother and head of all the churches of the city and the world, was originally built by Constantine over the barracks of the Equites Singulares, the Emperor's private guards, in 324. The Lateran Palace previously belonged to a rich patrician family, the Laterani, but in AD 67, Nero trumped up a charge of conspiracy against the head of the family and had him executed, so he could confiscate his estate. The palace became an imperial residence, and Constantine chose it as his own after his victory over Maxentius at the Milvian Bridge, but a year later presented it to the Pope in gratitude for his success. The first basilica was dedicated to the Redeemer, but vandals and earthquake took their toll, and at the beginning of the 10th century it was completely rebuilt by Pope Sergius III and dedicated to John the Baptist and John the Evangelist. Henceforth it was known as St. John on the Lateran. In his Paradiso, Dante wrote how
"The barbarians from the north stood in mute wonder mid the works of Rome, when to their view the Lateran arose in greatness more than earthly."
Though the building Dante and the barbarians saw is not the one we see today, the feeling it inspired was clearly one of awe. And that this is what the beholder was supposed to feel is reflected in the opening words of the introit of the old Mass of the feast.
"Terrible is this place. It is the house of God and the gate of heaven, and shall be called the court of God."
But this terrible place was almost totally destroyed by a fire in 1308, caused apparently by the negligence of some plumbers who were repairing the roof. Restored again, it was again burnt down and again restored. By the time Borromini was called in by Innocent X in the mid-17th century, there was precious little left of the original structure. In 1855, Leo XIII had the apse rebuilt. But although it was his favourite church, Pope Leo was unable to visit or officiate in his cathedral. As the London Daily Telegraph reported on August 21, 1899.
"The Holy Father confined within the precincts of his palace, a prisoner for 21 years, has never quitted the Vatican, has never felt free to visit the church, which, as Bishop of Rome, is peculiarly his own, the Lateran Basilica of Constantine."
Although on his death in 1903, Pope Leo was buried in St. Peter's, in 1924 his remains were transferred to the Lateran. and 5 years later, with the signing of the Lateran Pacts, the popes returned, and since then each has taken solemn possession of the basilica in his role of Bishop of Rome. The vicissitudes of the Lateran Basilica might seem far removed from the words spoken by our Lord to the Samaritan woman at Jacob's well, but the gospel for the feast of the church's dedication is surely not a casual choice, wrote St. Paul to the Corinthians.
You are God's building. Didn't you realize that you were God's temple and that the Spirit of God was living among you? The temple of God is sacred, and you are that temple.
And to the Athenians he declared,
The God who made the world and everything in it does not make his home in shrines made by human hands.
And although we need our churches, our covered buildings in which to worship God in an assembly, there is no single place, temple, mountain, or basilica, which alone possesses him. In the new religious spirit brought by Jesus, writes one scholar, God must be recognized and worshipped primarily in the inner consciousness. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth, writes Piero Bargellini.
Worship of the Father had to correspond to the fullness of divine revelation, that is, to the truth and to the purity of its essence, in other words, to the spirit. No geographic location would impoverish that worship, which would appear everywhere among all peoples.
Writes a biblical scholar.
In the language of John the Evangelist, the truth is the divine revelation which Jesus has come to communicate, while the divine spirit is poured out into men's hearts. Perfect worship, therefore, is faith in Jesus, in his word, and in the strength of the spirit which he gives. In this light, he can be identified with the Messiah prophet, whom the Samaritan woman is awaiting, together with her countrymen and Israel itself.
Taib was the name the Samaritans gave to the Messiah, and it meant he who returns or will return. I know that Messiah, that is, Christ, is coming, said the woman to Jesus, and when he comes, he will tell us everything. The woman would hardly have expected this stranger to answer, I am he, as he did. But she sensed something of the sort, and is so dumbfounded that she leaves her water jar and goes hot foot to the town to tell everyone, exclaiming, I wonder if he's the Christ. The episode at Jacob's well is as deep as the well itself. It takes us some time to get to the bottom of it. And talking of Jacob's well, it's still there, and you can draw water from it. I have a colour photograph in my kitchen taken by our parish priest on one of his visits to the Holy Land. In full view is the bucket and the rope to haul it up, and on the left a pilgrim is drinking from a paper cup. Various churches grew up over the well, but the most recent one, begun in 1914, was never finished. A project of the Pravoslav Church of Tsarist Russia, it was abandoned on the outbreak of the revolution. But let's get back to that historic encounter between an Orthodox Jew and a Samaritan, a woman at that. Wrote David Smith in The Days of His Flesh.
A Jew might not greet a woman. He might not talk with a woman on the street, even if she were his own wife or daughter or sister. In the morning prayer, the men blessed God, who hath not made me a Gentile, a slave, a woman. It was impiety to impart the words of the law to a woman. Sooner should they be burned.
And here was Jesus asking this woman for a drink. And not only was she a woman, but a Samaritan woman. She herself exclaims, How is it that you, a Jew, ask a drink of me, a woman of Samaria? And the evangelist explains, Jews, in fact, do not associate with Samaritans. But it was a lot worse than that. In the book of Ecclesiasticus, we can read,
There are two nations that my soul detests. The third is not a nation at all. The inhabitants of Mount Seir and the Philistines, and the stupid people living at Shechem.
The stupid people were the Samaritans. But Who were the Samaritans, and why were they so hated? And the feeling was reciprocated. When Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem, he sends messengers into a Samaritan village to make preparations for him, we read in Luke. And he goes on, but the people would not receive him because he was making for Jerusalem. And James and John, the sons of thunder, immediately turn to Jesus with a suggestion. Lord, do you want us to call down fire from heaven to burn them up? What they thought when they found Jesus talking to a Samaritan woman, we don't know. John, who was present, only says that they were surprised to find him speaking to a woman, though none of them asked, what do you want from her, or why are you talking to her? The Samaritans have been called the strangest and most ancient sect in the world. They claim that they are the only true representatives of the ancient children of Israel. They are descendants of a remnant of the original Jewish population of Samaria, and people brought to the region by the Assyrians after the fall of the Kingdom of Israel in 721 BC. Because of this crossbreeding, the Jews consider them impure. And when they began to rebuild the temple after the Babylonian captivity, they refused to allow the Samaritans to take part. In the 4th century BC, the Samaritans seceded from mainstream Judaism and built their own temple on Mount Gerizim, according to the plan of the temple in Jerusalem. In today's guidebook, we can read,
Gerizim, also known as the Mountain of Blessing, is the site holiest to the Samaritans, who believe that some of the events connected with the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, such as the binding of Isaac, occurred on Mount Gerizim.
From Jacob's well, where Jesus was sitting that day, it was easy enough to look up at the stony heights of the mountain, where, as the woman reminded him, our fathers worshipped. Today there is no temple on the mountain, only a heap of ruins, and the tomb of a holy sheikh, but we may read.
South of the sheikh's tomb is a flat rock which the Samaritans identify as the Rock of Foundation, from which the act of creation of the world started. The Samaritans consider the rock very holy and have fenced it. Near this stone is the place where the Samaritan community gathers every year to celebrate the Feast of Passover and sacrifice the Paschal Lamb, a custom practiced by the Samaritans ever since the days when their temple crowned the mountaintop. In previous generations, they used to camp on the summit of the mountain for the whole week of Passover.
In a book on the ceremonies at the holy places, there's a detailed description of what the writer calls the world's oldest rite, the aim and fulfilment of the Samaritans' existence as a people. And there let us leave them, the whole congregation clothed for the occasion in robes of white linen, facing the rock on the summit of Gerizim, which marks the site of the Holy of Holies of the Samaritan temple, waiting for the solemn moment when the sun drops to the horizon and the high priest turns to face the congregation, and the sacred rite begins. The Samaritans still worship in a synagogue according to their ancient and peculiar laws, we read.
The only books of the Bible which they recognize are the 5 books of Moses, and their most treasured possession is an ancient copy of the Pentateuch written on lambskin by, so they claim, Aaron, the brother of Moses. This extraordinary manuscript is written in the ancient Samaritan characters on the hair side of ancient sheepskin. The manuscript is in the form of a scroll wound on 2 rollers. The parchment is so old and brittle that it crinkles up and so brown that bits of it are illegible.
Today's Samaritans are still ruled by a high priest whose predecessor, centuries ago, was a rival to the high priest of the temple in Jerusalem. But there is no temple today, either on Mount Gerizim or in Jerusalem. And our temples today, our churches, are nothing to what our Lord and later St. Paul wrote of authentic worshippers.
The temple of God is sacred, and you are that temple. You are part of a building that has the apostles and prophets for its foundations, and Christ Jesus himself for its main cornerstone. As every structure is aligned on him, all grow into one holy temple in the Lord, and you too, in Him, are being built into a house where God lives in the Spirit.
And let's close with the words of the Welsh poet R.S. Thomas, who worked for 40 years as an Anglican minister to mainly non-conformist congregations. The people were Welsh-speaking peasants. The places, six different parishes set in the remote depths of rural Wales. A harsh, depopulated, deprived environment. A sense of isolation was inevitable. Only his Christian faith upheld him. Here now is The Moon in Llein, which reminds me it was at the tip of the Llein Peninsula that I bought this book of poems, in a church clinging to a hillside with the sea crashing on the rocks below. Aberdaron Parish Church, so-called Cathedral of Llein. It was believed that if a pilgrimage down the peninsula to the abbey on the island of Bardsey opposite was made three times, it was equal in value to one made to Rome. I don't know if Aberdaron was one of Thomas's parishes, but somehow reading the poem I get the feeling that it was there that he wrote it. And is there not something of today's gospel in the words, "People are becoming pilgrims again, if not to this place, then to the recreation of it in their own spirits"? But let's listen to the poem.
The last quarter of the moon of Jesus gives way to the dark. The serpent digests the egg. Here on my knees in this stone church that is full only of the silent congregation of shadows and the sea's sound, it is easy to believe Yeats was right. Just as though choirs had not sung, shells have swallowed them. The tide laps at the Bible. The bell fetches no people to the brittle miracle of the bread. The sand is waiting for the running back of the grains in the wall into its blonde glass. Religion is over, and what will emerge from the body of the new moon, no one can say. But a voice sounds in my ear. Why so fast, mortal? These very seas are baptized. The parish has a saint's name. Time cannot unfrock. In cities that have outgrown their promise, people are becoming pilgrims again. If not to this place, then to the recreation of it in their own spirits. You must remain kneeling. Even as this moon making its way through the earth's cumbersome shadow, prayer too has its phases.
Thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua, who wrote that program, with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett. And now, as promised, Joan Lewis, our resident Vatican watcher, who sat down with me for a chat about some of the last week's events here in the Vatican. Welcome, Joan. It's been a week since we've seen you here in studio. A lot of things have been going on. Number one, everybody has been watching what's been happening in the United States from Europe and from Rome here. And of course, the Vatican and Pope Benedict did send a letter of congratulations to Barack Obama for winning the presidential elections in the U.S.
He did indeed. He sent a message, which part of which says, because the Vatican said they were not going to release the whole message because it was a personal message sent from the Holy Father to the president-elect via, obviously, the U.S. ambassador to the Holy See. And part of the Pope's message is he sent his blessing so that God will support him and the American people. And he hopes that all people of goodwill can work to build a world of peace, solidarity, and justice. And then, of course, Father Lombardi, head of the press office, head of Vatican Radio and Television, he also was asked by journalists, obviously, for his hopes and an opinion and so forth. And he said, all of us are hoping that Obama will be able to meet the expectations and hopes directed at him. And he said he hoped that the man elected to be the United States is, as a matter of fact, it will be the first African-American president, which is why it was a historic moment, that he would work for the cause of right and justice and of rights, that make that plural, and justice, finding suitable ways to promote peace in the world, fostering people's development and dignity while respecting essential human and spiritual values. The faithful are praying, said Father Lombardi, so that God will enlighten him and give him a hand in his huge responsibility and that he will govern well. And as you said in opening remarks, obviously, this is something, is any other election watched around the world as carefully, at least a political election, as carefully as that of the United States?
So that's one of the big events, of course, which has been watched very carefully throughout Europe and especially here in the Vatican. But also another thing that we've been seeing going on here in the Vatican or in Rome is this Muslim-Catholic
yes.
dialogue, which has been going on. It started on Tuesday, November 4th. A group of Muslim scholars came from their various countries, some of whom I've spoken with actually from here in Europe. And they're here to meet with the Catholic scholars to talk about where we can go from here in terms of dialogue.
It's called the Catholic Muslim Forum, and they've held, like you said, their very first seminar in Rome. And their final message is being released really as we speak, because we do tape this show a bit earlier. So,
they were supposed to meet actually this day on Thursday with Pope Benedict.
With the Holy Father, exactly. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this really goes back to this meeting had its genesis, if you will, in 2006. And we really have to go back to September 12, 2006, when Pope Benedict gave his now very famous speech at the University of Regensburg when he was visiting his native Germany. And the actual title of his speech was Faith, Reason, and the University, Memories and Reflections, because, of course, he taught at Regensburg University for so many years. In the midst of that speech, very, very few words, one paragraph out of a 4,000-word speech, the Holy Father did quote remarks on Islam by a 14th-century Byzantine emperor, Manuel Palaeologus. And his comments, because of a sentence about Muhammad, did inflame Muslims worldwide. They condemned the speech. They asked the Pope for an apology and so forth. Well,
but he was quoting a Byzantine emperor.
Yes. And those were not his remarks. He made that in ensuing weeks and months very, very clear, the Pope did, that those were not his feelings. He did not share that point of view or anything. And so then the very day after he's made Secretary of State, Cardinal Bertone, on September 16th, he'd been made a day earlier Secretary of State, he issued a clarification of the Pope's speech. On September 17th and 20th of 2006, so respectively the Angelus and the Wednesday audience, the Pope again spoke of the reaction, saying he was sorry at the reaction to his Regensburg speech, and again, you know, clarified, explained his remarks. Then, interestingly, September 26th of 2006, the Pope invited to Costa Gandolfo. He invited 16 leaders of the Islamic community in Italy and 22 ambassadors accredited to the Holy See from countries with a predominantly Muslim population, and they met out at Costa Gandolfo. And then actually that very same year, October, just several weeks later, 38 Muslim religious scholars and leaders sent an open letter to Pope Benedict to point out, now this is quote, to point out some errors in the way you mentioned Islam. Then a year later, fast forward to October of 2007, a larger group, 138 Muslim scholars and clerics, sent another letter. It was entitled, A Common Word Between Us and You. And this is practically on the anniversary of the letter the previous year. Then October 12, 2007, a day after this open letter has been revealed, Cardinal Jean-Louis Touraine, president of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue, published a comment on the letter, in essence saying it was a very positive sign, an interesting letter, and a new document because it comes from both Sunni and Shia Muslims. Now, November, again, the same year, 2007, the Vatican released the text of a letter sent in the Pope's name by Cardinal Bertone, Secretary of State, to Prince Ghazi bin Mohammed bin Talal of Jordan, who was president of an Institute for Islamic Thought there, and he was one of the signatories on that earlier letter of 138 Muslim scholars. By the way, I should add, that letter, a common word, was addressed not only to Pope Benedict, but to Christian leaders throughout the world. We should make that clear. So anyway, in the letter of last November, the Pope makes it quite clear he would be very happy to meet a delegation of those 138 scholars and clerics. We just mentioned that meeting. And then there was a preliminary one. The preliminary meeting was March, 5 members from each side to set up this meeting. So the
And of course, this meeting is really just a part of what has been an ongoing dialogue between the Catholic Church and Muslim scholars that we saw really come out or get its impetus from the Second Vatican Council back in the 1960s.
Oh, that's true. There has always been a council for relations with Islam, and as there is one for relations with Jews and for promoting Christian unity. But this is like this more formal setting. This is called the Catholic-Muslim Forum. There will undoubtedly be other meetings after this November 2008 one. And the theme is very interesting of this meeting. It's love of God, love of neighbor. And they have been looking at many aspects of the question of love. It's not strictly a theological dialogue because that's not exactly what binds the two together, if you will, but there's many other aspects of understanding God and religious freedom and so forth.
Of course, also this past week, we have seen two important feast days for the Catholic Church, All Saints and All Souls. How did the Pope remark or remember these two very important feast days for the Church?
Well, interestingly enough, this year, of course, they fell on a weekend, so there was an Angelus on Saturday, November 1st. There was a second Angelus on Sunday, November 2nd, the Feast of All Souls. And I love what the Pope said on the Feast of All Saints. He said, "The world appears to us as a garden where the Spirit of God, with marvelous ingenuity, created a multitude of male and female saints from every age and social condition, of every language, people, and culture." And he said, "Each is different from the others in the uniqueness of his or her human personality and spiritual charism. All, however, are marked by the seal of Jesus, the imprint of his love."
And of course, he was asking us at this Angelus also to use the saints as models for holiness in our own lives.
And which is why we have canonized saints in the Catholic Church, why the Church seeks out, they have the religious leaders, why they seek out lay people to hold up as models for you, me, for everybody listening to us, because not to say that they were born saints. They became saints because of how, with heroic virtues, they lived their lives, often of pain and of difficulty and people contrary to who they were, what they were doing, and how many of them, of course, died for their faith, some directly. Those would be martyrs, but there's other ways of dying for your faith.
But speaking of dying, the Pope also said, in remembering All Souls Day,
sure,
we shouldn't be afraid of death.
No.
Because for Catholics, it's a beginning, isn't it?
It is. It's the end of earthly life as we know it, but it's the beginning of the life for which we were created. And I must say, a lovely thing that, of course, has been tradition now for many years in the Vatican is that the Pope went down on Sunday afternoon, about 6:30 or something like that, to the grotto area of the Vatican Basilica to pray at the tombs of deceased popes, to remember not only deceased popes, his predecessors, but also just to pray for the faithful, the departed. And so that's a very lovely custom, a very quiet moment, obviously, of reflection for the Holy Father.
We'll have to end it there, Joan.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, though, for being with us again this week. It's always a pleasure to see you and to hear, you know, what's been going on in the Vatican from your point of view. So thanks so much.
And we'll see you next week.
And a warm thanks there again to Joan Lewis, our resident Vatican expert and bureau chief for the U.S. network EWTN. And I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks again for listening to us all here on Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.